Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. D.J. O'Rourke wrote, quote, "Politicians are interested in people. Not that this is always a virtue. Fleas are interested in dogs," unquote. So Americans who simply could not abide a racially mixed woman, whose descendants represented the three major racial groups in the USA, have now to contend with a raging racist dictatorial president who has immediately set off to besmirch the White House for perpetuity, and who sees his chance to be an American Caesar, Caligula, and Hitler. And now, from The Guardian, by Robert Tate, "Trump's illegitimate power grab brings U.S. closer to dictatorship." The deceptive camouflage rendered the words almost banal, while still clearly communicating their ominous undercurrent. "Judges aren't allowed to control the executive's legitimate power," wrote Vice President J.D. Vance, a graduate of Yale Law School, on X, as he waded into an escalating tug of war between his boss, Donald Trump, and the U.S. federal courts. Whatever it lacked in rhetorical flourish or polish, the post represented an unambiguous rejection of long-established constitutional norms while deferring no supporting legal basis, some scholars say. It also amounted to an implied statement of intent to ignore court rulings which, if enacted, would upend the U.S. government's intricate system of check and balances and lay the ground for dictatorship, they warn. The vice president has absolutely no basis in the Constitution and its historical development for making this claim, said Bruce Ackerman, a law and political science professor at Yale University, Vance's alma mater. "It repudiates the fundamental principle of checks and balances." Vance's intervention was triggered by a series of court rulings that have slowed Trump's pell-mell rush to grab the levers of power across the U.S. government since returning to the presidency on 20 January. "Trump," Ackerman says, "has acted outside his legitimate power in arbitrarily shuttering institutions, including the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, the National Labor Review Board, and the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission, the latter two of which he has rendered inoperable by firing sitting Democratic members while not appointing replacements. He also summarily fired several inspectors general who are charged with rooting out government waste, fraud, and abuse across the executive branch without giving Congress the statutory 30 days notice. It is not the case that the president can dominate the policymaking of all institutions in the executive branch," Ackerman said, "and in particular, the president cannot fire people or members of these commissions. Even less can he, through unilateral action, simply destroy two independent commissions," Ackerman said. But the courts have issued a series of setbacks to Trump's crusade to remold American government, as several judges have ruled executive orders from the White House have ignored existing law or, in the case of an attempt to revoke birthright citizenship, violate the Constitution. Some analysts have speculated that Trump's attempts to seize unfettered control of the bureaucracy is based on the so-called unitary executive theory of the presidency, which argues in favor of an expansive interpretation of presidential power. The theory asserts that the president has sole authority over the executive branch of government and aims to centralize control in the White House. Based on the Constitution's vesting clause, which states that the executive shall be vested in the president, it has been favored by conservative justices on the U.S. Supreme Court in recent decades and championed by right-wing think tanks, including the Heritage Foundation, the main architect of the radical Project 2025 blueprint, which charted many of Trump's current attacks on the bureaucracy. But Ackerman warns that Trump's power grab and Vance's assertion of its unlimited contours is suggestive of something more sinister. This is dictatorship, he said. This is not unitary executive. This is something very different. It's a shattering assault on the foundations of the Constitution. It appears that Trump has ditched all pretense at respecting constraints in an approach that some warn is provoking a constitutional crisis and risking a descent into autocratic Caesarism. And that's in a quote. David Dreese, a constitutional law professor at Syracuse University, said Trump's ambitions extend far beyond the imperial presidency that many believe reached its apotheosis under Richard Nixon before being curtailed by congressional legislation in the wake of Watergate. What Trump is trying to do is steal all the power to administrate government from Congress and then use the judiciary to unravel the law, Dreesen said. Trump is challenging just about every constraint on his power and then hoping the courts will declare all the statutes that constrain him are unconstitutional. This throws the ball back to the courts. The question is really whether the courts are willing to stand up to constrain illegitimate power or instead get rid of statutes and congressional control by saying what the president is doing is legitimate, Dreesen said. The main thing is that Trump is disobeying statutes right and left, usurping congressional power of the purse, and that is illegal. It's just contrary to law and contrary to the Constitution, Dreesen said. Vance, for his part, is legitimizing a dictatorial power grab with his assault on judges. Vance's post is propaganda that serves the function of helping establish a dictatorship while avoiding taking responsibility for that, Dreesen said. Vance says courts should not control legitimate power, but most of these powers Trump is seizing are not legitimate. By suggesting that the court should stay out, he is suggesting that the courts should refrain from constraining the illegitimate power grab that is involved in establishing a dictatorship. It's not a framing that serves to legitimize things that are not legitimate, Vance says. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is engineer of this program. At the very same moment that Donald Trump is seizing the presidency as his own personal tyrannical throne, the annual commemorations of America's two most revered presidential birthdays are once again celebrated this short month of February. George Washington, known as the father of his country for leading the glorious revolution that freed American democracy from old world royalty, and Abraham Lincoln, the great emancipator whose Civil War presidency freed the slaves and restored this divided nation, paying the price of his own life. The mind of the bigot is like the pupil of the eye. The more light you pour upon it, the more it will contract, is a quote. And that was by Oliver Wendell Holmes. Another quote is by Alan Nevins, historian extraordinaire. Narrow partisanship and poisonous national suspicions and animosities can defeat the will of a majority of intelligent Americans and do injury to the best interests of the nation and the world. And now, February 14th is generally regarded as Valentine's Day, but it is also Oregon's birthday this year. Since statehood in 1859, Bob Fraser, reporter, columnist, and editorialist emeritus for the Eugene Register Guard from 1948 to 1977, the year he died, penned this ode to Oregon in celebration of his 117th birthday. Sometimes when you're in another part of the country, drive into a gas station with your Oregon license plates, or sign in at a motel, or just let it be known that you're from Oregon, unless you're in New York City, where people are grumpy. Chances are fair that somebody will say, "Aragon, you're a long way from home." "Sure am," you'll agree. "Are you on the top of, or in the middle, or is that Washington in the middle? You're the one with that oddball governor, the one who don't want people to move there. We've got a new governor now, but he shares some of the old governor's ideas. Must be nice out there. What's it really like? What's it like?" You think of the blind man and the elephant. One felt the elephant's side and concluded it was like a great wall. Another, feeling the leg, thought it was like a tree trunk. A third, after feeling the tail, said it was like a rope. A fourth grabbed an ear and knew that an elephant was like a blanket. That's Oregon. Oregon is a lush valley, green well into summer. Flowers and blossoms bloom in the spring. In the distance, a snow-capped peak smiles down on crops that will feed the cities. Oregon is that same valley in February under leaden skies. Puddles of water as big as lakes grow in the incessant rains. If the snow-capped peak is still yonder, it finds nothing to smile about. Oregon is droplets of ice and snow dripping from Hayden Glacier on the Middle Sister. Oregon is the birth of a stream, a rivulet that will become the North Fork of Squaw Creek, then Squaw Creek itself, then the Deschutes, which stumbles over Round Butte and Pelton Dams to make power. When those droplets reach the Columbia, they go over dams at the Dalles and Bonneville, more power. They help float ships and then mix with the salt water. Oregon is droplets of ice and snow dripping from Hayden Glacier on the Middle Sister. Oregon is the birth of a stream, a rivulet that will become the North Fork of Squaw Creek, then Squaw Creek itself, then the Deschutes, which tumbles over Round Butte and Pendleton Dams to make power. When those droplets reach the Columbia, they go over dams at the Dalles and Bonneville, more power. They help float ships and then mix with salt water over the Columbia Bar below Astoria. Oregon is a paneled boardroom in a 40-story building. Men in expensive suits are dealing in millions of dollars. Oregon is a great cattle ranch, 15,000, maybe 20,000 acres. The hands speak of pasture, but all one sees is sage and juniper. It takes 15 acres of this stuff to feed a critter for a year. The sun beats down, but nobody worries about fire. There is not enough vegetation to sustain a fire. Oregon is a dense jungle of salmonberry and salal, nurtured by the rains and fog of the Pacific and by mild temperatures the year around. And this does burn in the summer, horribly. The best vehicle for traveling is the machete. Oregon is the ubiquitous yellow school bus, hauling young Oregonians to school from the most remote corners of the state. Oregon is an ancient van filled with migrant workers, pushing on to the next crop and hoping nobody discovers the kids and puts them in school. Their help is needed at home. Oregon is another van of migrant workers hoping they can find a place to land long enough that the children can get the education their parents never had. Oregon is a laboratory at the state university where professors and students are trying to solve the mystery of the origin of life. Oregon is a lovely state park in the summer, jammed with people who wanted to get away from the crowds of the city. Oregon is a deserted shack on land too poor to sustain life. It is a symbol of lost hope. Oregon is a network of bridges and great strands and loops spanning a mighty stream. Ships from foreign lands whistle and go under those bridges with their draws pulled up. The great Fremont, the twisting Markham, the stately St. John's don't need draws. Oregon is a covered bridge over a quiet rural stream. Oregon is that stream where a small boy, barefoot, fishes in a deep hole. Oregon is that same stream early in the spring, that same stream flooded by the snowmelt and a dozen tributaries. It tears at the riverbank, destroys farmland, floods newly planted crops, perhaps destroys its covered bridges. Oregon is a stately Douglas fir, enough board feet to build as big a house as anybody needs. Oregon is a juniper, survivor of many a year of stunted growth. It casts a bit of shade. Under it, a rattlesnake dozes peacefully. Oregon is a hemlock log in the rainforest, a log that has been on the ground since most of us were babies. A new tree grows from its rotting side. Life goes on. Oregon is the Grand Canyon of the Snake, deepest in North America, and still untamed by dams. Oregon is an alpine meadow, newly freed from snow. Wildflowers grow right out of the ground with almost no stem. Their life is short, short and glorious. Oregon is a mountain that challenges men and women with ropes and pitons in the summer, a mountain that cloaks itself with beautiful powder snow at ski time. Oregon is the same mountain, dangerous and unpredictable. It lies in wait for the foolhardy at any time of year. Oregon is a wide, sunny beach where families build sandcastles. The hardy swim in the ocean at 52 degrees the year round. The curious poke around the tide pools by the sea stacks and rocky outcroppings, teasing the sea anemones. Oregon is that same beach in the teeth of a winter storm. A person can't stand up in those winds. Waves chew at the shoreline, which is never the same from one year to the next. Oregon is a field of wheat, hip high, swaying in the breeze. Oregon is a stream in the hard rock country where a miner, perhaps a businessman on vacation, pans for gold. Oregon is a rough road in the back country. Grass grows in the ruts. Oregon is a freeway, two lanes, three lanes, each way, choked at the rush hour. Oregon is a lonely sheep herder in the Basque country where Oregon meets Nevada and Idaho. Oregon is a fisherman, a commercial fisherman, remembering when his calling was in demand. Oregon is a tavern on a Saturday night. If there hasn't been a brawl yet, there will be. Oregon is a symphony, a play, or a ballet. The ladies and gentlemen are in formal clothes. Oregon is a suburban home, its lawn neatly manicured, two cars in the drive, perhaps a boat. Oregon is a flophouse where homeless men find company in their muscatel. What fire code? Oregon is a posh resort where a couple can drop $75 a day, even if they don't drink. People dress for dinner. Oregon is a sleazy hotel while accommodations are rented by the hour. No questions asked. Oregon is a road full of cattle being herded from one pasture to another. Oregon is a hospital where a baby is born, where an old man dies. Oregon is a church where a happy couple is married, a courthouse where an embittered couple is divorced. Oregon is a cemetery on a hill, an orchard of headstones, calling yesterday's roll. Oregon is like any place and not like any place. That's what Oregon is like, exactly. And that was Valentine to Oregon by Bob Fraser. And he wrote this on February 14th, Oregon's birthday, in the bicentennial year of 1976. And he wrote it for the Oregonian, of which he was a reporter.
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on A Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times-Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.